I don't think it helps to call anybody's argument unsophisticated or what Affleck was doing, which was, you know, gross and racist, because they, at the end of the day, they're not addressing the actual arguments. I feel like they're all talking over each other and we're not, and no one's really getting to the meat of the issue.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, good actors with bad rhetoric. Islamophobia. It's kind of like arachnophobia, but without the spiders and with Islam. And the definitive answer to the question, should humanists criticize Islam? All coming up on this episode of the Humanist Hour. Hello, everybody. My name is Bo Bennett. Welcome to the Humanist Hour. Welcome to this week's episode. This week, I thought, why not talk about what pretty much everybody else is talking about? And that's this whole Bill Maher slash Ben Affleck slash Sam Harris debacle, if you want to call it that, that showed up on Real Time with Bill Maher. Generally, I wasn't into this too much, but I just keep on seeing all these articles about it, and I read all these comments, and I just feel like jumping in there and say, what are you saying? It makes no sense. Are you reading what you're saying? And I don't think people are. So I thought, well, who's the best person to get on to talk about this? And there were two people that came to mind, and they were both from the ex-Muslims of North America. You've probably listened to one episode of the Humanist Hour before with Muhammad Saeed. And the other person we did not get the pleasure of speaking with, her name is Sarah Hayder. And she is one of the people who started that organization as well. They are both ex-Muslims, as the name of their website implies accurately. Two great people and two very educated people when it comes to this topic. So I am the guy in here who's just kind of throwing out the questions and throwing out opinions. But so you're going to listen to me and you're going to hear me say some things, but listen to them. They've got some really good ideas and they've got some great advice. So here we go. Here's my interview with Muhammad and Sarah. I have the great pleasure of speaking with Muhammad Saeed and Sarah Hayder. How are you guys?
Great. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you. Good. So we're going to be talking about today, should actors be allowed to discuss politics? Oh, wait a minute. That's the wrong question. The real question is, should humanists criticize Islam? And basically, of course, we can't just, I don't think we have the power of answering that question. But what we could do is discuss the pros and cons of such a question and maybe all the little sub-issues involved in this. And you guys are very familiar with this issue. Just to give our audience a little background, anybody who's, I guess, haven't been buried for the past 2 weeks probably have heard somewhere about this whole craziness going on with Bill Maher on Real Time with Bill Maher, and it was Ben Affleck and Sam Harris and a couple other panelists, and they really got into it with this whole idea of Islam and criticizing Islam and is it okay or does it make us bigoted and gross, I think was Ben Affleck's word. And you guys...
Gross and racist.
Gross and racist. Okay. Yeah. And let's throw bigoted in there too. Why not? And there before this, something else went on too with... who was the gentleman that you guys wrote about? The scholar, biblical scholar?
Reza Essen.
There you go. All right. And he had some words to say about a previous show that Bill Maher did, and he had some comments on it. So your initial thoughts and comments. Go.
It's very complicated, obviously. I don't know to the extent that people like Reza Aslan are helping. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think it helps to call anyone gross. And I mean, not that he said that, but I don't think it helps to call anybody's argument unsophisticated or what Affleck was doing, which was, you know, gross and racist, because they, at the end of the day, they're not addressing the actual arguments. And so I feel like they're all talking over each other and we're not, and no one's really getting to the meat of the issue.
Right. Which is what, in your opinion?
I mean, I think we have to address, and you know, now is as good a time as any, that there are too many people in the world, too many Muslims, that take the Quran or the scriptures of the Islamic faith as the literal truth. And that's something that has to change. And that's something that has to change now. And you can talk about how, you know, that's unfair to some extent, because Christianity had a long time to evolve and to change. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I don't think we can wait that long for Islam. And I think we have to quicken up that process in whatever way that we can.
Religions or ideologies or anything like that doesn't work on linear time scales. If you look into the past, around the 3rd century of Islam, it was a far more tolerant, diverse faith where it was willing to accept criticism. There were books written. There was a book written called The Fraud of the Prophets. The author was not murdered. There was a point in the Islamic world, the Abbasid Empire, where they were tolerant. The lack of religion was a thing. Mm-hmm. Criticizing the Quran was a thing. One of the largest arguments that early Islamic philosophers had was about the Quran itself. Those same arguments that we have had in the past can no longer occur.
So what happened? Where did this change occur? Could anybody point to a time in history or an event in history where this changed?
Like anything, it's complicated. There are probably many, many factors. Some of the factors are that, I would say the broader issue is that rationalism, reason declined. The dominant school of thought back then was called Mu'tazila, and they prided themselves on philosophy and rationalism. Mm-hmm. And that school of thought actually died out. We need to revive that tradition. Literalism has taken hold, conservatism has taken hold, but that isn't the entire Islamic story.
So literalism is part of the problem. So one of the arguments that was made, I believe this was made by Harris, he said that, and of course this is an opinion, it's not a fact, that Islam is the motherlode of bad ideas. So would you agree with that?
I mean, I wouldn't. In the sense that, and I mean, Muhammad can disagree with me here, but in the sense that I don't think, like, if you look at the actual scriptures of Islam, that it's necessarily much worse than the Old Testament. I think what's different today is the way that it is practiced, and not necessarily. I mean, what does he even mean when he says Islam? I don't think the scriptures are much worse. I think the practice is definitely much worse.
Right. And how exactly do you measure motherlode? Does anybody have a scale for that?
I'm sure it exists somewhere in somebody's basement.
Probably. Somebody has a motherlode scale.
To add on to that, I would actually argue that the Old Testament is worse than the Quran.
Worse.
The Old Testament specifically talks about genocide of the Amalekites. It talks about specifically about stoning women. Mm-hmm. In the Quran, there are vague references to that. Like, both things are referenced, but they're not clear-cut commandments. There are secondary texts called hadith that flesh that out a bit more. What Sarah was saying is people follow take it too literally, and therefore you have a significant amount of people that are willing to do things that in modern society should not happen.
Hmm. Right, and the Quran is, I mean, it does have less violent, like, incidences and less violent policies than the Old Testament, but also, I mean, it is much shorter, and you do have to remember that, which is, it sounds like a weird thing to take into account, but I think it is important to take into account, because it's harder to trip up, it's harder to have contradictions when the book is itself, the text itself is much shorter.
And the text itself was allegedly written by one author, correct? In scholarship, is that still seen as true, whether it was Muhammad or not?
So the scholarship on Islam is relatively slim. Only in the past 50 years have people started studying it. And the bulk of the work that should come from Muslim countries does not exist. There are only academics in the West that are studying it, and there are a handful of people that have. So the linguistic analysis hasn't been done. The historical analysis, it's very, very little data exists at the moment.
Hmm. So we don't know if one author wrote it or not. Or we don't have any indication that that is true.
Yeah, we don't either ways. According to Islamic mythology, it was revealed to Muhammad over 23 years, and it was written down 20, 30 years later, after he passed away.
After he passed away?
Yeah.
How do you manage that one?
His followers basically wrote it, compiled it. Disagreements that happened over time, and to counter those, the followers got together and wrote what they remembered down, and that's supposed to be the inerrant version that Muhammad revealed to Muhammad.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, I want to touch back on this point that you guys talk about, Sarah, that you mentioned that the Christian Bible is much more violent than, I don't know if that was your word, than the Quran. I think that is so interesting. And it's kind of ironic when you hear a lot of criticism against Islam and the violence in the Quran. And yet all these are a lot of Christians making this claim. And yet, you know, I always have to wonder if how many of these Christians actually ever read their own Bible. But that's always the big question, isn't it?
You know, I don't think Christians read their Bible. I don't think Muslims read the Quran. You know, mm-hmm. Honestly, I think there's a lot of ignorance of their own faiths going on in, you know, all over the place, especially among Muslims and Christians, I think. There are a lot of Muslims who have never truly read the Quran, mostly because, you know, they don't speak Arabic, and that's supposed to be the best way to read it. That's supposed to be the best way to understand it. And so if you can't read Arabic, if you don't understand Arabic, you're already, you know, a little bit handicapped, and your understanding is going to be handicapped. So you just sort of rely on what the scholars say. I don't think, you know, and I think the same is true for Christians. I think a lot of Christians don't read the Bible, and they don't really know what it actually says. A lot of people pick and choose to a certain extent, that's perfectly fine. You can pick and choose what you like about a faith. And I actually wish Muslims would do that more often than take it as, you know, 100% inerrant, literal policy guide, right. Which is how a lot of, you know, extreme sort of fundamentalist Muslims view it. And I think that's the problem, that you aren't allowed to pick and choose in the Quran.
Yeah.
I'd like to add to that beyond fundamentalists and conservatives who do view it that way, most moderates and liberals view it that way as well. They don't follow it that way.
They don't understand that what they're doing is picking and choosing.
Yeah.
And even when they do understand that that's what they're doing, sometimes they say, you know, well, it's because I'm weak. You know, I definitely think the full veil is the right thing to do and the right for women. But, you know, I'm living in America and I'm weak, and so I can't put it on myself, that sort of thing.
Gotcha. Yeah, from what you guys are saying, I see just so many similarities with Christianity and the Christian Bible. And we have our fundamentalists as well, as many of whom think that the Bible, word for word, should be taken literally. The only thing that Christianity has that I don't think Islam has is the get-out-of-jail-free Jesus card. Because the Christians could point to Jesus and say, oh, no, you see all that stuff about stoning and the gays and all that stuff? That was all... You know, that's old school with Jesus. He just took care of all that stuff. And now it's just love your neighbor. But from what I understand, Islam doesn't have that get out of jail free, does it?
No.
So you have to look at the Quran and you have to say, okay, well, I guess this is God's word. Now, how do we make sense of it? And there are many people in the Muslim community that take it literally, as you say, and word for word, but they don't exactly follow it. Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Beau Bennett, and we are speaking with Muhammad Saeed and Sarah Hayder.
I would say it's more that they take it literally, even if they don't follow it, they adhere to the fact that it is literal, and that makes them susceptible to extremism, because when it's pushed to them, that what they're doing is immoral and wrong. They have no way to counter that.
I see. So they can say, well, you know, he really didn't mean that, and that was old school stuff. I mean, they have to say, yeah, well, I guess that's true. And
exactly.
You know, like, yeah, it's more of, you know, well, I think homosexuality is wrong. I wouldn't attack a homosexual, or I wouldn't personally persecute them in any way, but I do think it's wrong. And sure, I mean, there's no direct harm to homosexuals being done in that way, but it adds on to this whole, you know, to persecution of minorities, just because there's some guy out there who's saying, well, you know, it's actually, I do believe that that's right. And maybe that guy that's, you know, psychotic, who's doing all those things, it's understandable and, you know, maybe even morally good.
Right. Okay, so let's kind of circle back to our original question. Should humanists criticize Islam? And if we do, what are the pros and cons? Now, of course, the argument goes back and forth that, well, if we do, we're kind of bordering the line of being bigoted or racist. What do you guys think about that whole racist idea. And both of you are, were Muslims, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Would you feel offended when people criticize Islam?
Probably. Back then, yes.
Back then, yes. Okay. And that's one of the cons, definitely, of criticizing somebody's belief system. And from what I understand as well, there are obviously there's Christianity, there's Islam, there's Judaism, and Islam is very closely tied in, like the identity, the culture, the laws, the faith, all of it is kind of really bundled, where Christianity is a little bit more separated.
I mean, simply because somebody would be offended is not a reason not to criticize.
Right, right. Okay. And I'll definitely let you expand on that as well. I just wanted to finish up the point that that from what I understand about Islam, that it is very bundled into the culture and the laws and the identity of the person itself and the faith. So when you... And tell me if you think this is fair. When somebody does criticize Islam, yes, we're criticizing the idea, but the idea is so tightly woven into everything the person is about that it's criticizing a part of the person as well.
Well, I think you can say that about anybody, right? I mean, you can say that about Christians, about fundamentalists or not even fundamentalists, like Christians who really identify with the Christian, like call themselves, you know, I'm a Christian man or I'm a mm-hmm. Christian woman. And they when they say that, they mean I'm a morally good person. I'm a morally good,
right.
You know, man or woman. And I think so that is true, that a lot of people take that to be their identity. And when mm-hmm. I was Muslim, that was such a important central part of who I thought I was. That I would have been offended if someone was criticizing my faith. And I was, you know, and some people know this, but I talk about it anytime I get the opportunity that, I mean, I left Islam because I met, well, I mean, not because necessarily, but, I met a sort of raging atheist kind of person, like a very like militant guy who was, you know, out to prove me wrong. And he printed up a bunch of, you know, hadith and scriptures from the Quran and verses from the Quran, excuse me, and said, well, this is what you believe. And I was so offended. I was deeply offended. I thought I felt like he punched me in the face. Like it felt worse. You know, it felt worse than that.
We call that tough love.
But in the end, that's not who I was. You know, in the end, that was the only way that anyone could have gotten me to examine my belief systems that quickly, you know. And then once I looked into it, the change from being, you know, a practicing Muslim to an atheist happened very quickly. I would say, you know, within the course of a month, I knew enough to leave. But that, you know, initial slap in the face was kind of what pushed me to re-examine something that was so central. It's kind of like, you know, to a certain, like, it's something you take for granted when you are a Muslim. Like it's like gravity. Of course, this is real. This is something, you know, that exists, and this is the truth. And you never ever think about it. So to a certain extent, you need that. You need reasoned critique coming out of somewhere. It doesn't have to be boorish. It doesn't have to be, you know, in your face.
Right.
But it has to be there.
We need to make a distinction between those that are criticizing and generalizing and are bigots. It's very common. It exists in America. We mm-hmm. experience it. We started ex-Muslims in North America to provide communities for ex-Muslims and to give them a voice. But we constantly get contacts from people that want to use our experiences to rail against Muslims. So we need to be very careful to distinguish between somebody that is actually making real critique and is actually, it's tough love, versus somebody that has an agenda.
Right.
And when you say has an agenda, you're referring to the bigots or
yeah.
somebody who's just prejudiced?
So often, like what you were talking about earlier regarding Christians condemning Muslims.
Right.
And their text being saying that their text is horrible without reflecting onto their own text.
Right.
Right. And I mean, and it's hard. I absolutely understand sort of the difficulty as a humanist. And I face this difficulty myself, and I'm right in the middle of it, where I don't want to feed into bigotry. I don't want to feed into that narrative. I don't want to provide ammo to the kinds of people who would use it to push, you know, sort of bigotry and xenophobia against Muslims. It's hard to find that balance between the defense of Muslims from the extreme right while making a secular leftist sort of reason critique on against Islam. But, you know, I mean, and it's a tough line to walk. But I think some part of it, you have to understand, you know, where are you coming from? And before you make a critique or before you make, you know, a reasoned attack against Islam, I think you have to sort of know yourself and understand, like, where is this coming from? And that's the advice I would give, you know, humanists. You know, are you educated in the faith, reasonably educated? Do you think you are being more fair to Islam or less fair to Islam and Muslims than you would be to your own faith, like, or the faith that you came from, you know? And it's, I believe scriptural critique is always fair. Practice, I'm not so sure.
Yeah. You know, one of the questions that I forgot who threw it out in one of the shows, are Americans less likely to criticize Islam? And I assume the person was referring to as opposed to a religion of their own culture. And my response to that would be, well, yes, because there are so many people I speak with, so many atheists who talk a lot about Christianity, and the Christians always come back with, well, how come you're not saying things about Judaism or Islam? And the response of the atheist is, well, we don't really know much about that. But a good portion of the atheists in the United States grew up in a Christian culture, myself included. I know what I'm talking about when I talk about Christianity and when I criticize Christianity. And I think that is one of the issues with Americans being less likely to criticize Islam.
If it's any consolation, we get the reverse all the time, that we hate Islam and that's why we criticize Islam, and why do we not criticize Christianity?
Well, that would make sense, I think.
I mean, of course, and that's very understandable. And I think that's a very liberal way of looking at it, that, you know what, I don't understand it. I want to understand it. And I think that's actually a very simple thing to do. I don't think it's hard to understand sort of the basic tenets of Islam, or at least understand it to the extent that most Muslims understand it. Like, you don't need to understand it the way a scholar would, you know. You just need to understand it to the extent that a practicing Muslim.
So one thing, when you're criticizing Christianity or Judaism or any other theology, most of those criticisms are transferable. The existence of a God, the existence of evil, like...
Yeah.
You don't really need to know Islam to be able to criticize.
That's a very good point.
Theological themes.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. All right, so let's talk about the issue of Islamophobia. Is that a real thing or what? And what does that even mean? To be afraid of Islam.
Well, it's a weird word, I feel like. You know, I don't know how I feel about it. Mostly I feel, you know, negatively, in the sense that I don't exactly know what it's describing.
Exactly.
Is it, I mean, I think a lot of times people use that as a proxy for, you know, racism or bigotry against people who are perceived to be Muslim, which to me is a very different thing than Islamophobia. Yeah. And to the extent that we use it anywhere else, I mean, we don't say, you know, I don't know what Judeophobia would be. We use anti-Semitism, right? And to me, that makes sense. But criticizing an ideology or having an irrational fear of an ideology makes no sense to me, especially an ideology that if put into the wrong hands, who are taking it very literally, can be a very violent thing and a very scary thing. So in that sense, is it irrational? So I don't like that word, and I especially don't like how it's used in discourse, which is mostly, I feel, it's a shut down discourse, right? It's the same kind of thing where what Ben Affleck was saying, where he was telling Sam Harris that you're gross and you're racist. Right. That didn't address what he was saying at all. That just called him gross and racist.
Exactly.
And I think I don't think that helps anyone. We can talk about why something is problematic. We can talk about why putting all Muslims into into, you know, one monolith is a problem. So statements like Muslims do this or Muslims believe Y are unhelpful. We can talk about that. And then you can counter that, of course, with saying that, you know, there's definitely patterns that are visible among Muslims throughout the world, even in different cultures. And that's a conversation.
Mm-hmm. And there's also statistics to back a lot of those claims up.
Right. There are statistics. There absolutely are. And I think to the extent that they are ignored is baffling to me. People like to remind, I mean, this always happens on anything I read about Islam or, you know, violence or, you know, anti-women stances in Islam or among Muslims. Someone always has to bring up, well, there are, you know, this is a faith of 1 billion people. And we have to remember that this is not, many Muslims don't believe this. And that's true. And I think it's sad that we have to talk about that. Like, we have to remind people that, you know, there are a few people that are doing this, but everybody else isn't doing this. And that's baffling to me that you even have to be reminded. Otherwise, you're going to hate your Muslim neighbor. Having said that, I think you can definitely say, and it's fair to say, that there are certain kinds of social attitudes among Muslims that are backwards and that sort of allow extremism to sort of run, free without any checks, you know? Because if in the back of your head you do believe that, well, you know, leaving Islam should have some consequences, then maybe you're not going to speak up when somebody, you know, targets an apostate or, you know, targets somebody who converts into another religion, even.
Right. Yeah, and I think it would be wise for anybody, Christians, atheists, to keep in mind if they are the ones making any of these broad claims, which I can't stand when people make those blanket statements anyway, like all people do this or everyone does this, or even if you leave out the all and every, you're still kind of applying it when you say Christians believe this. Well, we know, and I think Christians would readily admit this, that not all Christians believe the same thing. I mean, maybe you could say Christians believe Jesus was God or something like that. And even then, you still have a small percentage of that whole group who will deny that and still call themselves Christians. But the point is that there's so much variance in there. And I know we hate it when somebody makes a claim about atheists, like atheists do this or say that. No. Atheists simply do not believe in God. That's the one thing we have in common.
Sure, absolutely. And I think that it's a tough line to walk, you know, to not say that specifically. But I think it's perfectly fair to say, well, here is this, you know, verse that's being interpreted by many extremists in a very, you know, in a very bad way, you know,
right.
Or this is a verse that is often implemented in Sharia law, or, you know, and which is actually the case, that there are a lot of countries in the Muslim world that implement parts of Sharia law and have it in the actual penal code, which is very, very, it's very, very bad news. And to a certain extent, you should be able to target that and say, this is wrong and this is bad. And Muslims need to get on board with that as well. So it's wrong to say, well, all Muslims support, you know, oppression against women, you know, because they might not even be aware that that is what's causing it necessarily, or what extent their faith is playing.
So if they're reflexively defending Islam, saying Islam is feminist without actually looking into the scripture, then to a certain extent they're playing into it, because they then don't have the tools to stand up and say that, okay, these parts are bad and we all should ignore them.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, I want to shift directions here for a second. I want to ask you guys something from your experience. And Sarah, this might be a question better for you. Within the culture, do you find that many of the women do actually feel oppressed and they're just too afraid to say anything? Or are they comfortable in that part of the culture and comfortable playing that role?
I think it depends on the woman. But I would say that for the most part, they don't know to the extent, because, I mean, so when I was growing up, when I was Muslim, I was told over and over again that, and this is very common, by the way, that Islam actually liberated women and it gave women rights that they never had before, and Islam is at the forefront of women's rights. And as a Muslim woman, you are freer than if you weren't a Muslim woman. And this is repeated over and over and over again till you believe it. And I believed it. And even when I was young, I called myself a feminist and I called myself a Muslim. I didn't find that there was any conflict in that. I didn't know that there was a conflict in that. To a certain extent, it's not about being comfortable in that role necessarily. It's just about not knowing anything else, you know? And I think, so for Western women, this creates, there's kind of a friction. For Western women who are, like Western Muslim women, who are, you know, mixed into Western society, who aren't, you know, isolated in some little, you know, Muslim town and a small Muslim community, which many Muslims are, I would say. But for the woman that's you know, intermingling, and immersed in Western society, I feel like those are the kind of women that are feeling that conflict, that are not comfortable with their place in Islam. And I do know women like that. I do know sort of educated women who understand how this is working and sort of how religious factors are playing against them. And they are sort of contemptuous of it to a certain extent. I wouldn't say that's the great majority of Muslim women, because I would say from my experience, at least from my moderate Muslim community, that it was very isolated, and it was very women were not encouraged to mix into, you know, broader society. And most friends you had were Muslims and were other Muslim women who will repeat the whole, you know, Islam actually values you. You're like a diamond. You're like, which is a very common thing, by the way, saying that you are, this is what people say when they say, you should wear the hijab. It's like, you're a candy, and like any good candy, you should be wrapped. Like, why would you want a candy that's unwrapped and in the street and everyone's touching it? You wouldn't want that.
No, you don't want strangers licking you.
Right. I was told that, you know, I'm a pearl or I'm a jewel, and because you know, my father wants to keep me and wants, you know, like any jewel, you hide it. You don't, you know, show it off, which is weird, but whatever.
Yeah.
So you're told things like that, and you believe them to a certain extent. I think you only question it when that conflict comes up, when you see women in Western society, you see the freedoms that they're given, that you start to question your own.
The bigger question here might be, is it right to impose our cultural beliefs and values on other cultures? Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Beau Bennett, and we are speaking with Muhammad Saeed and Sarah Hayder.
Yeah, and I don't actually think that it's about, you know, our culture versus their culture kind of thing, because when we say our culture, we're talking human rights, right? Like Muhammad said, we're talking liberal values, and I don't think that's, although that might have began in the West or was, you know, became really popular in the West, I don't think that's necessarily the concept owned by Westerners or, you know, owned by, you know, Western people. It's human rights is a human concept, and it has come up here and there, even in the Muslim world, but trampled down for one reason or another. And like Muhammad said, there's even Muslim societies aren't a monolith. So I think this is very interesting. I hear this a lot from liberals where they say, well, you know, we feel uncomfortable because, like you said, who are we to say that their culture is wrong? And like this was specifically, I'll give you an anecdote. When I was talking to somebody who... we were talking about FGM in particular, and this was a gender studies professor, and she said, well, who am I to say that FGM is wrong? Who am I to condemn them for FGM? That's female genital mutilation, for those who might not know, but I'm sure everyone does. But she was like, who am I to condemn it? I don't know their culture. I don't know their values. Who am I to condemn it? Maybe they're happy the way they are. But again, like Muhammad said, that's disregarding that there are many people who are fighting against it, but they are small. You know, they're like any liberal sort of the extreme progressive front. It's always small. You know, and they're never. I think it's strange that sort of liberals in the West would judge other societies by the moderates, by the majority rules. You know, but then while they are here, while we are in the West, we're pushing all sorts of, you know, liberal values, and that we consider, that we think that should be accepted by everyone. But we don't support sort of the liberals who are doing the same in their hometowns.
Yeah, right.
One other thing that I'd like to point regarding the anecdote that Sarah was talking about, somebody making the choice does not exist in a vacuum. You need to have the ability to make a choice. If I am saying I can or cannot do, but if I, for example, wearing the hijab, you have the choice, quote unquote, to wear the hijab. But if you do not wear it, there are these 100 consequences that will happen. You're not really free at that point.
Yeah.
So we need to work on eliminating all the consequences for all these choices where somebody had, if they're wearing the hijab today or not wearing it tomorrow or doing any of these religious things or not following any of these religious things, there are no consequences anywhere.
Right. Yeah, just like God gives you the choice not to believe in him if you don't want to. You just got to spend eternity in hell.
Yeah. And which I'm okay with that. Right. I'm okay with that. I don't believe in hell, so that's okay.
Yeah.
But just don't do anything to me today. Don't do anything to me here. And that's, I think Muhammad brings up a very good point that people, like a lot of people bring this up when it comes to hijab, that a lot of hijabi women do say, you know, it's my choice. And to them, I would ask, you know, to what extent, if you took it off today, would you face any consequences? And social consequences matter. We have to consider them. And they're deeply important to a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
I'd like to circle back to one thing you were talking about. I think Sarah brought it up about how it's often pushed that Islam is a feminist religion and it freed women. And this is a popular idea that's pushed onto Muslims a lot. And Nicholas Kristof wrote an article about this whole issue going on. I think in the New York Times. And he said, like, again, from even our perspective, there are some wonderful traditions in Islam. But simply because somebody is saying this tradition is wonderful does not mean that it actually is. That needs to be examined.
Hmm.
A Muslim person that is trying to make Islam look good will say a lot of things. Some of them will be true. Some of them will not. Everything needs to be examined critically. Regarding that specific claim that women were liberated under Islam, that is categorically untrue. The thing is that the focus was on a very small community. That small community may have been retrograde and moved forward from that. Muhammad's life, in his life and himself, like his first wife, this is pre-Islam, was a businesswoman. She had her own business. She hired lots of people, sent them all over the Arab Peninsula. She hired Muhammad. She proposed to Muhammad. All of this existed prior to Islam. So say that everything before that was the women's rights does not exist in that period is a lie. And again, this is coming from Muslim sources. This isn't coming from some historical source.
Was this the 9-year-old?
No,
this wasn't the 9-year-old. This was the 9-year-old is Aisha. This is Khadija, who was his first wife, and he was married to his first wife until she passed away, actually, and that's when he started acquiring multiple wives. It wasn't until she passed away. She was married to him when she was 40 and he was like 25, and she was a businesswoman who had a lot of money and who had a lot of power and control over her own business. Muhammad's point is that. The freedom that she was given, the control she had over her own life, even her marital situation, who she wanted to marry, who she wanted to, you know, propose to, and how she wanted to run her business, those same freedoms you couldn't say existed to the same extent after Islam came into the picture. So the claim that Islam freed women and gave women all these sorts of rights is not true, because we know Khadija had these rights. We know she was a businesswoman. We know she had, you know,
she proposed to Muhammad.
Yeah, she proposed to Muhammad herself. So she had certain freedoms. So people sort of they claim this over and over. That's what Muhammad, I think, is trying to say, that Islam gave women all these kinds of rights. And Nicholas Kristof did repeat this, and it irked the both of us. That he did say this, because it's not even true, not even according to Muslim sources.
Gotcha.
Another anecdote regarding that. Muhammad was from the city of Mecca, and later in his life he moved to Medina. A lot of his followers moved to Medina. In Islamic history, there's mentions of the women in Medina being more open and willing to challenge their husbands, which the people from Mecca did not. And there are references to how that annoyed them, that because of moving to Medina, we have to encounter these women that are willing to challenge us.
Ah, interesting. Wow, what great history. You guys are very educational, thank you. Well, and that kind of brings us to the final point that I was thinking about with this whole thing. Are we, or should we actually be criticizing Islam or Christianity or Judaism or any of the religions, or is it really the lack of critical thinking that this all comes back to. Because, of course, you see the Christians, they could look at the Bible, which you pointed out is a heck of a lot more violent and has some terrible, horrible things in there and direct commandments, allegedly from God. And yet Christians are able to look at that and put their critical thinking cap on and say, well, you know, that was a while ago and things have changed. That was for the culture or whatever. And really, I think what they're doing is they're just reading their own morality into the Bible instead of getting their morality from the Bible. But it does come back to critical thinking and education. Do you think that somehow, I don't know if pushing is the right word, but somehow promoting education and critical thinking in these different areas could be a good solution to the problem without really offending anyone?
Well, I mean, critical thinking is always a good thing. I would never be, you know, against that. Of course, that's, I think, the cornerstone to starting to think about things like this. I don't know if I feel comfortable saying, well, you know, it's just that Christians are able to think critically now, and that's why Christianity isn't as, you know, isn't taken as literally as it can be, or isn't as extreme as maybe it could be. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think there's always going to be fundamentalist or extremist people who want to push their religious agenda in whatever religion. We do see this in America with Christians, right? I mean, we had the Hobby Lobby thing that was so sad, actually,
sure,
the ruling. But I mean, they're always standing there. They're always there waiting for you to stop paying attention, and then they'll try and take control and take power. I think the biggest hurdle that Islam has, that Christianity doesn't, is that you have governments that are secular. Islam does not. In Muslim majority countries, like I said before, the majority of them have some aspect of Sharia law that is ingrained. There is no such thing as, you know, separation of mosque and state the way there is here. So here you are fighting against Hobby Lobby, right? Like the ruling. Was just, I mean, it was so bad for us, right, as secularists. But you have to imagine that even the fact that was happening is something that is, you know, unheard of in Muslim countries. Like, of course the religion will get its way, and you won't be able to take it to court. You know, you don't have any right to even challenge it. And I think that's actually what I would pinpoint as the base of the problem, is the fact that the state itself is prone to being theocratic or is very sympathetic to religions and gives them special, you know, special privileges. I don't think that if the privileges of separation of church and state were taken away in American government, I have no doubt that extremist Christianity would take over. Hmm. It would just be, I think, a matter of time.
But don't you think if there was some kind of reform injecting reason and critical thinking and rationality into the culture, then maybe that government would change,
right,
by demand from the people.
And that's a part of it. But I think, like, it starts, sure, I can say that's how it begins, that you have, you know, scriptural critique and rationality and all of this. Science education is a big one. Mm-hmm. That maybe causes people to push for change in their governments. Once that change is there, I think there is a certain amount of safeguard, you know? You don't have to worry so much about extremism taking over at any point, because they really, it's difficult for them, or more difficult for them, you can say, to take over the government or to take over the people, the minds, you know, the legislative body. And I think that's very important, and I think that's the most important thing.
So I would say the case for secularism hasn't been made in the Muslim world. There hasn't been robust debate about what the role of Islam is. Most people accept it that Islam is perfect, and therefore, of course, it should have a role in the state. And it's pushed repeatedly in countries all over the Muslim world. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a vigorous debate on whether this is tenable and what actually happens as a result of that, which we've seen time and time again throughout history, whenever religion and state intermingle. That conversation needs to happen, and we need to enable that, because those conversations won't happen in those countries, because in Saudi Arabia, you can't really talk about secularism. If you do, you're in jail with 1,000 lashes prescribed to you. Mm. So Muslim intellectuals and liberal intellectuals need to talk about this very seriously. What are the consequences, and how can we promote this within Muslim communities? And going back to the tough love thing, when Muslims, like, we need to not shy away from pointing out flaws that exist, both within scriptures and within the dominant narratives that exist within Muslim communities.
Okay. Sarah, any final thoughts?
Sure. I mean, I wanted to sort of emphasize, you know, that it is difficult to talk about Islam, and I think it is difficult for humanists to talk about Islam, and I think that it's important that they talk about it in an educated manner, and to some extent that means taking initiative and looking into the religion yourself. It's not actually that hard, you know. It's not actually that complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that you have to worry so much about, you know, am I going to sound bigoted or you know, biased or racist? Because, I mean, there are people that apply that label to very fair critique all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, of course, be careful of that and mind that yourself. And that's the best way, I think, engage it, because we really can't say, well, the Muslim community has, you know, outcries of, you know, this is racist or Islamophobic. I don't think that's a good gauge of whether or not something is or isn't Islamophobic or, you know, racist or bigoted.
Right. Yeah, good points. And I would just add to, if you are criticizing, and this goes for anything, not just Islam, but anything, make sure you stay away from absolutes. All,
right.
Every, stay away from blanket statements by saying, well, Christians do this or the Jews do this or anything like that. Stay away from those kind of statements. And if possible, yes, go ahead and cite a percentage. Cite, well, I saw a poll, I saw a study that said 38% do this. And even if you are going to say most or many or whatever, you're going to use those kind of qualifiers, make sure they're accurate and make sure that you could support them and back those up with facts. Otherwise, just shut up and don't say them.
Yes.
That's my advice to them. All right, you guys, thank you so much. It's so great having you guys out here and fighting for the cause, fighting the good fight. Saying the smart things that you guys say. It's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us again. And Sarah, it was nice speaking to you for the first time.
Thank you. It was really nice being here.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You guys take care. That was Muhammad Saeed and Sarah Hader from the organization known as Ex-Muslims of North America. I'd like to speak a moment about this whole idea of bigotry or racism when we criticize an idea known as Islam. Well, first of all, if you look up racist, not that dictionary definitions are the authority of what the word actually means, although some may say that's true, but this whole idea of racism, it's understood at this day and age that race is not a biological construction. That race is a social construction. It's something that we have come up with in order to help us categorize the different groups of people. And race these days is not just by color of skin, but it's by a whole bunch of different things, including religion. So if somebody says that we're criticizing a religion of a group of people, technically, it's not that far off to say that that could be declared a racist comment. And the same thing would go for Christianity. If we're criticizing Christianity, we could say, well, that's kind of like a race as well. Now, again, that's kind of stretching the argument, but I'm just trying to look at both sides here. But really, when it comes down to what is bigotry and what is racism, there's a psychologist named Paul Bloom, and he's over at Yale University. He's got a bunch of TED Talks. You can look him up online. He talks about this idea of prejudice and stereotype and how it's not always a bad thing. In fact, prejudice and stereotype actually come about as a necessary cognitive function, a necessary bias that we all have to make sense of our social environment without having to expend so much cognitive energy all the time trying to get all of the facts about everything. We just could not possibly do that given our limitations. So what we do is we have heuristics, we have shortcuts, and we make judgments about people based on initial impressions. And of course, this is not always fair. And that's not the point. But generally speaking, it tends to be beneficial and it tends to guide us through our social environment. But when it comes to criticizing other people, we have to realize, especially when we're going public and we're making public statements, we do need to realize that not all people are the same based on their religion or based on their looks or their culture or any other factors. We are all individual people. We are all unique. And I think that's one of the main points that people like Ben Affleck and Reza Aslan are trying to get across, that we have to be very careful when we talk about Islam in terms of maybe even not if we directly, like Sam Harris is directly being bigoted, although he's been accused of that, but it may be possible that he's deliberately inciting racism or bigotry by the facts that he is sharing. I would certainly argue that that's not his fault. It's the fault of the ignorant people who are listening to what he's saying and using that as a form of ammunition to fuel their own prejudice and their own racism. And that's not a good thing. So there are my thoughts on that. It was just a wonderful conversation to have with Muhammad and Sarah. I'm very fortunate to have had that opportunity. And I want to thank you once again for listening to The Humanist Hour. If you do have any feedback on this episode or any other, please feel free to email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call the listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you so much, everybody, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.